The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So what I thought about talking about tonight is happiness. Happiness in our practice, happiness in meditation, happiness in meeting our lives with mindfulness. I think often the Buddhist teachings are framed around suffering, the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. There is suffering in our experience. Not that everything is suffering, but that suffering exists, and that understanding that suffering is a key towards releasing it. So there's suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there is a possibility of release from suffering, and there's a path of practice leading to the release of suffering. And so that framing of the teachings, often oriented around suffering, may have us wondering, where is the place of happiness in this practice? Is it all about just getting to know suffering? Is that what I'm supposed to do? Look for suffering and understand it? Well, this Four Noble Truths could also be framed kind of as there are things that get in the way of happiness, and there are causes for those. And then happiness is possible, and there's a path that can lead to happiness. Because that third noble truth, the truth of freedom from suffering, the Buddha said that that freedom was the best happiness there was. It's called the great happiness, to not be caught in the ways that we habitually suffer. And so I'd like to explore how happiness is cultivated, what we can notice in our practice, and just to explore a little bit about happiness tonight. Happiness in other framings of the teaching actually has a very firm foundation in the unfolding of the path of practice. There's one teaching where it's called the lawfulness of progress. And this is a kind of a series of steps that if you start here, then very lawfully these things unfold. I'll read just a little bit of this to you. For one who is who engages in ethical conduct, there's no need for an act of will. May non-remorse arise in me. It's natural that non-remorse will arise in one who engages ethically. In one free of remorse, there's no need for an act of will. May gladness arise in me. It's natural that gladness will arise in one that's free of remorse. And it goes on. For one who's glad at heart, it's natural that joy will arise. For one who's joyful, it's natural for serenity to arise. For one who's serene, it's natural for happiness to arise. And it continues on all the way to freedom. And so these beautiful states that are mentioned here, delight or gladness, joy, happiness, serenity, these are firmly on the path of practice. They naturally arise as we begin to engage in exploring our experience with mindfulness. So these words that are used here, delight, joy, happiness, you know, they have meanings in English that we might typically think of, or ways that we associate being delighted, joyful, and happy in the usual way that we use those words. And, the usual way that we are delighted and have happiness is when we get what we want. Now, this is our habitual kind of way of navigating the world. It's kind of what we've learned. It's the way that the culture encourages us. It's kind of the way that we think happiness will follow. And the Buddha acknowledges this form of happiness. There is a form of happiness that comes from getting what we want. The Buddha calls this, there's one place where he talks about the kind of happiness that comes from being a lay person, the kinds of happinesses that we can have. And he says there's the happiness of possession, the happiness of having, the happiness of acquiring wealth in a skillful way, the happiness of having the ability to support our families, to be able to support ourselves. And so there's a happiness that comes from having. But very often this kind of happiness that we usually orient to in our lives has a little bit of, it's tied up with suffering in some way. Because we orient to the having. We orient to getting things that we want. And, you know, we have this notion, okay, when I get what I want, I'll be happy. And there is that moment of happiness. There is a moment of delight in having something that we like or in the act of getting or the act of getting rid of. Likewise, you know, if there's something we don't want in our environment, there's a kind of a happiness of being able to control our environment so that that thing is not there with us. So we have this kind of habitual way of navigating the world. We try to control the environment, to get rid of the things we don't like, to control things so that we have the things that we like, and we have some measure of happiness that comes from that. But that happiness is bound up with the movements of wanting and aversion. We have a moment when we get something that we want where we have a happiness of the getting. And that moment, we get that thing, and that happiness of having that thing will last as long as it does, often not that long. You know, some things the happiness may last a little longer than other things. You know, you buy a new car or something like that, and perhaps the happiness of having a new car lasts for several months. You know, you've got the happiness of it, of the confidence that it's not going to break down on you, or, you know, the happiness of it running really smoothly. But, you know, it doesn't last that long. And even while it's still running smoothly, we've already lost the appreciation for it. And, you know, it's like, oh, it's just we take it for granted. So that the happiness of getting things that we want doesn't tend to last very long. And the way that we know, like the last time we were happy, when we kind of enter into this place of, oh, you know, okay, well, things are kind of okay, but, you know, I'm not very happy right now, or it's like things are just kind of okay. So how can I be happy? And we start thinking about, well, what do I want? And so we look for something to want, or we think we find things that we don't like to get rid of them. That was actually my orientation for happiness in before I met meditation. It actually kind of took me by surprise when I saw how strong the habit was. You know, I would basically walk into a room and orient to what I didn't like, thinking, that needs to be fixed, that needs to be changed, that needs to be gotten rid of, I can fix that, I can do this. And I didn't notice what was nice about the room. I was focused entirely on what I didn't like. And so that was my orientation. Happiness came from getting rid of unpleasant things. And so the happiness of that, our usual kind of happiness, we have the happiness of the getting the thing and of the getting rid of things. There's a kind of a pleasure that comes in having something pleasurable with us or getting rid of something unpleasant. But what we don't see about that is also there's a piece of that happiness that comes from... Well, I have to take a step back because the process that's at work here is that there's wanting going on. We want something. In the very moment where there's something that we want, there's a little bit of a sense of dissatisfaction in the mind, a sense of offness, like, oh, I want that thing. I don't have it. Oh, things aren't right. I need to get that thing in order to be happy. And so there's this wanting that's happening in the mind, or in the case of unpleasant things, there's an aversion that's happening. Oh, that thing's unpleasant. How can I fix it? How can I change it? And so there's the aversion happening, and or there's the wanting happening. And often because we're so focused outwardly on what's happening in the world, on the thing that we want or the thing that we want to get rid of, we don't notice the experience of wanting or the experience of aversion. We're entirely focused on the getting or getting rid of the thing that we want or don't want. And so we miss, in a way. We don't consciously recognize the offness that comes with the wanting itself or with the aversion itself. But we do feel it. There's a way that we feel it. And we think that that offness needs the thing, needs to have the thing or get rid of that thing in order to go away. And so we get the thing. We get, maybe it's as simple as a nice meal or a piece of chocolate, or maybe it's as major as getting a job that we want. You know, we get that thing. And in that moment of the having, two things happen. We have the happiness of getting the thing, but we also have the release and the relief from the wanting going away. We tie these two things together in our mind. We think the only way to have that wanting go away is to get the thing that we want. That we feel somehow like we'll be in a state of perpetual wanting if we don't get that thing. That's the story that wanting tells us, that we'll be in a state of perpetual wanting if we don't get that thing. And so when that wanting goes away, there's a feeling of release, a feeling of relief that I will propose to you is actually the greater part of the happiness that comes from getting what we want, is the fact that either the wanting or the aversion has gone away. And so that's a kind of happiness that learning about this process of how our usual mode of happiness comes about, that if we can be curious about the wanting itself, if we can, you know, in this normal way of navigating our lives, maybe we'll find something that's like, oh yeah, I want that thing. What happens if I just decide, rather than focusing on the thing that I want, turn to the wanting itself? Feel that experience. Feel the experience of wanting and see what happens. It's a mind state. It won't last that long if we just watch it. It may come and go if it's something that you really want, but you can watch it. You may watch it diminish. And then you will see the possibility of the kind of happiness that can come not from getting something that we want, but from simply seeing the wanting go away. When the wanting goes away, the offness goes away. And so you can explore that a little bit. Begin to look at this wanting and the aversion itself. Instead of being so focused on what we want or want to get rid of, turn towards that experience itself. And so this usual way of finding happiness, which the Buddha acknowledges, yes, there is happiness in getting what you want, and a large part of that is the release of the wanting. So there's some happiness in getting what you want, but it is a lesser kind of happiness. It's like there's way more refined and lovely forms of happiness out there. There's one place where a poem in the Buddhist texts say, if by giving up a lesser happiness one could experience greater happiness, a wise person would renounce the lesser to behold the greater. I think most of us would probably agree with that. that if we really understood there was a greater happiness out there, we would let go of a lesser kind of happiness. And so we could say that part of our practice is beginning to explore the possibility of these greater kinds of happinesses, so that we can let go of this kind of endless cycle of wanting something and having it and then losing the happiness of it because it's such a fleeting thing, and then feeling like, well, that's the best it can get. Let me just find something else to want. Wanting to want in order to find that moment, that just that little hit of happiness. This is so much the way we've lived our lives. And so the Buddha points to other ways that we can find happiness. And that's really what I'd like to explore. So there is happiness of sense pleasures. I just was talking about the happiness of getting things that we want or getting rid of things that we don't want. But, you know, almost paradoxically, as we start to turn to being in the present moment, there's also a kind of happiness that can come very simply through sense pleasure. You know, as we become present in our lives, and not caught in all the thoughts around, what do I need to do later? Or, oh, I've got this problem at work, I have to figure this out. Or, oh, that person that said that thing. You know, we're walking down the street, and basically we're in our world of stories, our world of problems, of confusions, of wantings, and we're not really present for what's going on. As we enter into the present moment and start being available for what's happening, we begin to touch into some very simple happiness that can come just by being present, by being available for walking down the street and seeing the trees or feeling the sun on your face. Just some very simple, or seeing a bird fly by. Really simple kinds of joy. This delight that comes, it comes in the sense realm. You know, it comes through sense pleasure. But, you know, I really think that the pleasure that comes from that is more about a kind of an intimacy with experience, a being with experience, an availability for being here, and not being caught in all of our thoughts about what we need to do. It brings a richness into our lives, a sense of a fullness, happiness in just the simplicity of being alive. And this kind of happiness is not at someone else's expense. You know, the material resources of the world are finite. And I think this is one of our practices around happiness is to begin to explore, is it possible to be happy in the happiness of others? And, you know, this is actually said to be one of the more difficult kinds of happinesses to cultivate. Because, I think because we have this habitual way of thinking about happiness being in terms of getting things, having material things. And there is a finite amount of material things. And so I know that when I first started exploring the notion of happiness, I thought if somebody else was happy, it meant there was less there for me somehow. That it was a zero-sum game. This kind of happiness that comes from just the simplicity of being present, there's an infinity of that. It doesn't take anything from anybody to connect with our experience in this way. And so this kind of happiness that is possible through just a simple presence. Now, it's not easy. It's not easy to do this simple presence. It's simple. Simple to describe, not easy to do. Because of the habit of our mind, the ways, you know, first of all, the ways that we think, oh, I have to get these things, get rid of these things. If you watch the stories that go on in your mind, you'll see lots of them have to do with how can we arrange our lives in order to get things or get rid of things. And so if we can let go of those stories for a little while and just enter into the present moment, we can start to see this kind of more, you know, small moments of very simple delight. I'm going to just talk about a variety of ways we can meet happiness as we explore being present and cultivating our minds and hearts to open and be connected. The practice of the Buddhist practice, the practice of opening our hearts, is about opening our hearts to what's happening in here, what's happening inside of us, recognizing where we get caught, where we can feel these very simple moments of happiness. And it's also about the relationship we have with other people. So the practice that we do, I mean, we cultivate a lot of it in silent sitting meditation. You know, this is a lot of what we talk about is meditation here. And yet so much of the broader practice of the path towards happiness, this deep happiness that we're exploring tonight, happens in relationship. So it's not just about looking at ourselves. It's about looking at how we are with other people. And so we begin to explore, what does it mean to have a happy connection, a heartfelt connection, an open connection with other people? And one of the ways to explore that is through generosity, through giving. Giving is not just about giving material things. That's one way to give. But giving of your time, giving of your heart, giving of your presence. When somebody is sad, being willing to sit with them and not try to fix it or change it. If somebody needs some support, needs a ride to the airport, the generosity of offering a service to give them a ride to the airport. So many different ways we can give in our lives. It's said in the teachings around generosity that the happiness of giving has got a long impact. Because as we think about giving, if we're not contracted around it, I mean, we have to be wise about giving. You know, we have to look at what's possible for us. Do we have the resources? Do we have the time to offer this? So as long as we're giving wisely, then the giving is said to make us happy before we give, while we're giving. And then if we reflect on it afterwards, we also experience a happiness afterwards. I have had, you know, many experiences of this, but I'll just mention one that was really, really simple, but probably deeply felt because it happened at the end of a 3-month retreat. I'd been sitting in meditation for 3 months and was pretty open, pretty present. And when I the last few days of the retreat, last 3 or 4 days of the retreat, we started having conversations with people and talking, and somebody pointed out to me that I'd had a box sitting in front of the office, a package. Somebody had sent me a package, and it had apparently been sitting there for a while, and I hadn't noticed it. And so I went and got this box and opened it up, and somebody had sent me 2 pounds of See's chocolate, or maybe it was a pound of See's chocolate, and some bags of barbecue potato chips, and maybe some other things, but those are the things I remembered. And my immediate thing was, oh, I can share these. And the delight that came with thinking of how people would be happy. I mean, these are people who'd been sitting for three months, and, you know, we would get a lot of tofu for meals, and, you know, a lot of rice and beans, and, you know, there wasn't a lot of See's chocolate on the menu. And so I, you know, just the idea of offering the See's chocolate just is like, oh, they're going to be so delighted. And so the potato chips too. So I set out the potato chips and the chocolate on the back counter where people offered things. And I sat there. I said, this is offered. And I just sat there in the dining hall. I had a cup of a coffee and I was sitting there drinking my coffee and just watching people come and see their eyes light up as they see this box of Sees chocolate and delight in me as they, you know, had that moment of delight. So there was the delight before, thinking about it. There was the delight during, as I was sitting there with my cup of coffee and watching people come in and find the chocolate. And then there was the delight remembering it afterwards. So now this is a trivial example. But just, it's actually surprising, though, how much joy was available in that really simple kind of giving. And so, you know, that exploration of giving and the joy, the happiness that is available there. Also in relationship with people is the happiness that comes with engaging with people in a non-harming way, in meeting people and with an open-hearted connection with other people, there's an inclination to, you know, not harm them, to not create or cause suffering for them. You know, so there's some simple guidelines that we're offered to refrain from killing, refrain from taking what's not given, refrain from a false speech, refrain from harming with our sexuality. So some simple guidelines around non-harming. And in speech in particular, it gets more refined, you know, to not say harsh words or divisive words. You know, just finding ways to speak that are non-harming. So non-harming through our actions, our words. And this is the thing I started with, the engaging ethically. As we engage ethically, as we orient in our relationships to non-harming, we have non-remorse arise. You know, we no longer have the regret of having something come out of our mouths that was harmful or hurt somebody. And so the more we can practice with this non-harming, the more we have that sense of, yeah, it's like we're secluded from the sense that we've done something that created sadness or pain for somebody else. This has a name, the bliss of blamelessness. This non-remorse can create the bliss of blamelessness. We are secluded from feeling like, you know, that remorse, that regret. And if you also watch your thoughts and look, you'll see how much we go back to things we've done wrong or things where we've harmed somebody. Oh, I wish I hadn't said that thing. Or times where we're, you know, even engaged in something like a, you know, what seems like a small lie, you know, maybe what we think of as a white lie. You know, how often our minds will go back to that. Oh, that person knows that person. And, oh, what if they tell that? And that person finds out that I lied to them. Oh, you know, we experience that kind of agitation of mind when we've engaged in ways that can create harm for people. And so this bliss of blamelessness creates the conditions for the mind to settle, for the mind to be at ease around relationship. This is huge. This is a really important part of happiness that's available for us as we engage in this path of how we can be happy. You know, if we're framing this in terms of happiness tonight, you know, the practice of finding happiness, we are not going to find happiness in ourselves if we are engaged in things that will create unhappiness in others, because there will be ripple effects in our minds around that. And so this is something for us to explore, this ethical conduct, the happiness of non-harming. Then there's the happiness of connection, again, in the terrain of relationships with people. The open-hearted connection when we feel, I wish you well. When we start to recognize, you know, when I said earlier that it's hard for us to wish somebody to be happy in somebody else's happiness. The open heart can wish someone well and take delight in their successes. And so we explore this possibility. I mean, sometimes we can, it's easier in a way, I mean, the first practice of kindness, of simple kindness, of just, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you be at ease. Sometimes those are framed in the negative. May you be free from suffering. May you be free from harm. May you be free from danger. May you be free from struggle. And that can be easier to wish, that kind of freedom from struggle. Often with people that, you know, we may not actively wish happiness for, we realize we don't want them to be miserable. You know, so we can wish that for them. May you have some ease in your life. And then that creates a feeling of an open heart. And that feeling of the open heart, it alters our relationship with other people, but it also alters our relationship to ourselves. It's quite amazing. So much, I think, of our going through life trying to get what we want and get rid of what we don't want is basically trying to be loved. You know, we want somebody to love us. We want people to like us. We want people to see us. We want people to reflect that for us. And so much of what we do is in the name of being loved, having somebody love us. And I've discovered in my own experience, when that gets turned around and we begin to connect with the sense of the possibility of wishing well, of wishing that somebody's happy, wishing that they're peaceful, the heart that is not constricted around that wish, the heart that just openly and freely can say, may you be well. For me, when I've experienced that feeling, and I definitely don't live there all the time, but when I have experienced that feeling, that experience of wishing well, the metta, the love coming from here, unconditionally, no need for anything in return, that feeling is the feeling that I had been looking for from somebody else. It's available in here. We're not really looking to be loved. We are looking to learn how to love. And that experience of learning how to love changes our relationship not only to others but to ourselves. It's quite beautiful. There's a deep happiness that comes with that. A deep sense of ease, of not being in conflict with the way things are in the world. And as that gets stronger, then we can also genuinely delight in the happiness of others. You know, the joys that other people have. And that's another great one. That one is like, that one really doesn't cost anything, you know? Happiness in somebody else's happiness. The Dalai Lama famously said, it must have been 15, 20 years ago, because he said, it's good to be able to take happiness and the joy and the happiness of others, because that way you increase your chances of happiness 6 billion to 1. And we'd say 7 billion to 1 now. 7 billion people on the planet. If we can delight in the happiness of others, we increase our chances of happiness manyfold. That open heart does also, it resonates not only with the joy of others, but it also resonates with the sorrow of others. And, you know, it's a different kind of happiness, the happiness of compassion. But it is, it's an unconstricted heart that is not fighting the suffering and is available to be generous and give of your presence when it meets the suffering of others. And so this heart quality is also a form of happiness that comes in our practice. And then there's the happiness of meditation, the happiness of concentration. As the mindfulness, as we, you know, there's certain different kinds of practices in meditation, but just the simple practice of being with the breath, coming back to the breath over and over again, being with one particular experience, as a concentration practice, that can create a very kind of stable, still mind. And in that, a lot of what happens is the ways that our mind habitually reacts to things begins to weaken. We start to recognize that it's actually okay to be hanging out with the breath. It's more than okay. It actually feels really good. Concentration feels really good. And part of the reason it feels good is because the habitual ways of reactivity in our mind, we're kind of secluded from those as the mind settles in and is just hanging out with one experience like that. And so we begin to recognize, again, a kind of happiness that isn't dependent on our usual forms of getting and getting rid of, but just a simple presence brings a deep kind of peace, a deep kind of delight, a deep kind of happiness. It's not easy to get to that kind of happiness with concentration. Some people have more capacity at it than others. For myself, that kind of concentration practice is something I need to work at. But I have found on some retreats where I was doing a concentration practice, that very stable kind of just being with the breath for long stretches of time. Very, very deep states of well-being. A state where it just feels like everything is pointed in the same direction. No conflict with anything. And when we start to maybe just get little tastes of that. Maybe even for just a few moments we get a taste of the mind that settles down. And we begin to recognize that so much of the way that we suffer, so much of the way that we react to things, and so much of the struggle, the agitation in our minds, is optional. We begin to see a different way, you know, this way of settling and stabilizing the mind. And then there's a happiness that comes more with the mindfulness practice. The practice as we turn to our experience. Briefly earlier I was talking about being present and being available for the small moments of delight and joy in our lives. That's one way that the mindfulness can bring moments of happiness. But often as we turn to our present moment experience, as we open with mindfulness to what's happening in the present moment, you know, it's not all sweetness and light. You know, we see how much we struggle. We see the ways our minds react. We feel anger. We feel confusion. We feel pride. We feel irritation. And it doesn't feel good. And we think, why do I want to be present with this? You know, what's the point of this? But we begin to recognize over time as we turn towards that, those states. You know, even very quickly, you know, in the early years of my practice, turning towards anger, looking at the experience of anger, and, you know, my mind was run amok with anger when I first started this practice, but pretty quickly, you know, and I didn't trust it either. You know, somebody said, well, I'll try mindfulness, you know, pay attention to your anger, don't act on it, just notice it. And I thought, well, you know, that's just going to make me more angry, isn't it? But, you know, I was willing to give it a try. And what I discovered was that, you know, as I turned towards the anger, well, it felt pretty bad. I did notice that. But it also seemed to cut the loop. You know, the way that the mind kept feeding it and feeding it and feeding it. I had seen definitely that once I got into an anger loop, it was really hard to get out of it. And what I discovered with mindfulness is it was the way out of that loop. It didn't make me feel good right away, but it did create the conditions for a weakening of that pattern. And so begins our delight in the practice around looking at difficulty. You know, it sounds paradoxical, but the more we practice, the more we turn to our reactive states, the more possibility there is for delight in the seeing of it. We are delighted that we're seeing it because we know if it wasn't seen, it would be deepening itself. It would be reinforcing itself. And so there is this possibility of, as we see it, initially when we turn to look with mindfulness at our reactive emotions, at our difficult states of mind, it's hard. But over time we begin to have confidence in the mindfulness to support the weakening of it, to support the cutting of that reactive cycle. And as we see it, we're delighted, because we know what it's doing for us. We appreciate the value of this practice. And so this actually can be experienced as delight. I remember on one retreat, I was sitting in my room a lot of the time, and I had a roommate. I was in Burma and had been assigned a roommate. And she was very respectful of me. I had to do my meditation lying on my back because I have a back problem, and I do my meditation in my room lying on my back. And she was, you know, mostly in the meditation hall, but she would come in around meal times and come in, and I was kind of ready for her to come in. And one day she came in early. And what I watched my mind, I mean, I had been meditating for many weeks by this point, and I heard the key in the lock, and my mind just went, no, don't come in. And I just saw this whole pattern of reactivity just like dominoes falling. But this was seen from the position of witness, of just watching it happen. And the witness, the seeing that happen, it was like, wow, that's amazing. Look at all of that unfold, and I'm not caught by it. Thank goodness I'm not caught by it. So there was a delight, a joy that arose in the seeing of that just unfolding. And so the practice itself, even the looking at the difficult states of mind, can begin to be a form of happiness. And we start to see these little reactive patterns coming up sooner, you know, much earlier. And, you know, it's like they become mindfulness bells for us. They wake us up and we can appreciate, oh, right, here I am. I'm starting to get irritated. Ah, be aware of it. And thank goodness mindfulness came back for that so that it doesn't entrench itself further. So this is a kind of happiness of the practice. And then, as we practice more, we begin to recognize there's kind of moments of happiness around what I'll call not suffering. You know, it's a more subtle kind of happiness in a way. It's akin, in a way, to the appreciation of moments of simple sense pleasure. Because in those moments, basically, not much is wrong and you're available to be there for those moments. And initially, our mind will kind of pick up on the pleasant aspects, perhaps, of walking down the street. You know, the light as it plays on the tree, or a beautiful flower, or a pattern on the pavement. You know, just something that the mind notices and takes delight in. And then it goes a little deeper than that, to the place where we actually appreciate non-suffering. Moments when things aren't particularly wrong, but they're not what we would call great either. It's just a moment when there's nothing wrong. Things are okay. We often miss okay moments because we are so concerned with finding the next really, you know, happy moment of our usual way of thinking happy. And so often these moments of just non-suffering kind of go by us. Like, just imagine right now, you've broken your leg, you have a big cast on, you have to use crutches, you probably can't drive. Imagine your life. Imagine getting out of bed with this big cast on your leg, having to have the crutches there, how hard it would be to get out of the bed. Well, all the things you have to do to get ready to leave the house, and, you know, if you have to get in the car and drive, I mean, probably you have to have somebody else do that for you, so arranging that. Just imagine how it would be for you to have that. And then imagine the cast is gone, the leg is healed. How would that be? That would probably feel pretty good. You know, no longer having that challenge of navigating the broken leg. Well, that's the way we're living. Nobody in here has a broken leg. We're all living our lives with that kind of okayness. Appreciate, seeing if you can appreciate the small okaynesses in your life. We often orient, and I understand there's some biological reasons for orienting to what's wrong. You know, it's like the classic example, you know, if you're in the savannah and, you know, you need to stay alive, you're going to want to orient to the tiger or the things that are a challenge for you. And so we often orient to things that are wrong or things that are struggling, and we miss no problem. When it's no problem, it's like, oh yeah, don't need to pay attention to that. So we miss it. We miss no problem. But no problem is actually the doorway to a very, very deep kind of happiness. And so you might, the mindfulness, as we explore mindfulness and being in the present moment, the moments of non-suffering, the simplicity of being able to get out of bed in the morning, that moment of non-suffering. Now, there may be some suffering in that. I tend to get very stiff, and so my body is pretty stiff when I get out of bed. But, hey, I can get out of bed. So, you know, appreciating the moments of non-suffering. the mindfulness begins to make that available to us. Sometimes it can be good to explore this. You know, transition times are actually a good time to explore this. You know, if you're having finished a meal before you get up from the meal, is there a kind of sense of okayness? You know, you're not hungry, you're not trying to get your food ready. It's like, whew, there it is. The moment before you feel like, oh, I've got to go on to the next thing. What is that moment like? So any transition moment, any time where you're moving between activities, you might just check in. Is there a feeling of a moment of, ah, that's done, ha, okayness there, before the mind launches into the next thing? Sometimes the simplicity of sitting at a stoplight. If you've left yourself enough time to get somewhere and you're sitting at a stoplight, there's not necessarily a problem. Can you be available for no problem here? What does it feel like when nothing's wrong? Recognizing this is a subtle experience, but it's a doorway, a gateway to a very, very deep kind of peace. Because that moment of no problem is a pointer to a moment free from greed, free from aversion, and if you're present, free from delusion. And that's the freedom that the Buddha was pointing to, the great happiness that Buddha was pointing to. So, I guess I talked the whole time. So, thank you for your attention. And if any of you would like to ask questions, you're welcome to come up, and I'll stay a few minutes afterwards. Thank you.